Well, welcome to class number 5 of our 10-part series on creation and evolution. At the rate we're going, it's going to take a long time to cover all the material. We left off last time talking about the age of the Earth. And that's what we're going to talk about for the next few sessions, actually. How old is the Earth? It is a key component in, I think, in the creation-evolution controversy. The testimony of Jesus in Matthew 19:4 was that the creation of Adam was the beginning. Now, you'll find many scoffers today will say, well, the ancient people talked about the earth being 6,000 years old because they didn't know any better. What are they trying to imply by stuff like that? We're smart, they're dumb, right? Had a question-answer session at the church I was at a couple nights ago. Where was I? Wisconsin. This one, we had people lined up at the microphone to ask questions. And this one scoffer was there. His professor was sitting out in the crowd, sending the student up to ask questions. And I would be sweet and kind, but I'd just, you know, blow the student out of the water, you know, as my answers. And he'd go back, and the professor would put his arm around him, and, well, you know, you should have said this. Well, professor, why don't you get up here, you coward? You know, if you got something to say, come ask me a question. But see, that way he can maintain his composure by sending the students out to be sacrificed and not have to do it himself. But the students kept making statements like, well, you know, the average person in this room probably doesn't understand what the complexities of science. I said, hold it. Folks, let me translate that for you. What he's saying is, he's smart, you're dumb. He said, that's not what I meant. I said, how many of you took it like that? Nearly every hand went up. It's exactly what they mean. And when Jesus said the creation of Adam was the beginning, a common response you will get, people will say, well, the ancient people were just trying to explain the world to a bunch of ignorant shepherds. They phrase it slightly differently, but it all boils down to the same thing. We're smart. Everybody else is dumb. In other words, if you don't believe like us, if you don't believe evolution, you're not smart. And that attitude reeks off of some of these guys. I mean, you got to really watch for that. So Jesus said pretty clearly the creation of Adam was the beginning. Here the textbooks are teaching the earth is literally billions and billions of years old. And they'll say the universe is older than that. All through the books you see the phrase, millions of years ago, billions of years ago. I mean, the books are full of this in this county. I mean, in the Bible Belt. Every place I go, they claim to be the buckle on the Bible Belt. I've always wondered where it really is, you know. We've even got some Christians going around teaching the earth is billions of years old. Hugh Ross has a large ministry called Reasons to Believe. He is one of the key leaders today of the movement of among Christians saying the earth is billions of years old. And I don't know if I got all of his books, got quite a few of his books. I toured his ministry a few weeks ago when I was out in Southern California. He teaches the earth is billions and billions of years old, and God had to have billions of years in order to get us here. Well, the God that I worship, number one, he doesn't need billions of years to do anything. He can do it in no time at all. Secondly, he certainly doesn't need to practice. He can do it right first time. He doesn't need to throw some material out there and let's see what happens to it. He doesn't need billions of years to prepare anything for anything else. He just, poof, creates it. So, the earth is not billions of years old. Now, who cares about this topic anyway? Let me show you the importance of this. I think it's extremely important. The credibility of Jesus is certainly at stake. The credibility of the book of Genesis is certainly at stake. Genesis teaches very clearly, if you add up the dates, that the earth is about 6,000 years old. And Jesus quoted from Genesis 25 times. Apparently, he believed in it. If you want to get a fascinating chart, and there's too many pages to make a bunch of copies of for tonight, but in the back of the Defender's Bible by Henry Morris is a chart showing all of the New Testament references and Old Testament references that refer back to Genesis. There are 200 New Testament references referring back to the book of Genesis. It's very neat to read all these passages in here. If you want to get this chart at page 1550-something here in the Defender's Bible. But 1556. Nearly every other book in the Bible refers back to Genesis. I think there's maybe two exceptions that do not refer to Genesis. So this topic, I think, of the age of the earth is, and Satan knows this, of course, this is the way to undercut the entire Bible. You destroy the credibility in Genesis, and you might as well throw the rest of the Bible away. And the scoffers certainly know this, too. Now, a fourth reason, the evolutionists care about this topic, because if the earth is not billions of years old, the whole theory of evolution looks awful silly, doesn't it? I mean, think about it. If I say, if you kiss this frog, it'll turn to a prince. That's obviously a fairy tale, right? But if I tell you the frog can turn into the prince slowly, somehow the human brain can accept that. And that's precisely what evolution is teaching. The frog turned to the prince, but it happens slowly. it's still a fairy tale. But see, the evolutionists will fight tooth and claw over this issue about the age of the Earth because this is the first hurdle they have to overcome. In order for evolution to be true, zillions of things have to be true also, and this is the first obstacle they face. How old is the Earth? I was asked to go speak at this church in Iowa one time, and a lady came to the meeting, and she said, "Brother Hovind, my husband's an atheist. Would you please talk to him?" I said, "I'd be glad to." I went over to the house the next day, sat on the couch, and he sat on the chair. We talked for 2 hours. All we talked about was the age of the Earth. Didn't get to talk about the Bible, just talked about how old is this Earth anyway. The guy was an engineer of some type, I forget now, very smart man. After 2 hours of what I'm about to share with you, information that proves the Earth is not billions of years old, after 2 hours he looked at me and said, "Wait a minute, you know, the Earth is only a few thousand years old, you're right." But he said, "That means it had to be created, doesn't it?" I said, "Yes, sir, and that's really what I came to talk to you about." But it took me 2 hours to get there. Of course it had to be created. But see, sometimes you have to go through the lay the groundwork before you can reach them with the gospel. And I think the age of the Earth is a critical place to start. Tonight, we're going to begin with some scientific ways to show the age of the Earth. I think it's pretty obvious from Scripture the Earth is about 6,000 years old. But what about science? What does the world itself teach us about its age? There are several ways you can approach this, and I try to give people evidence from space, evidence from physical things on Earth, and evidence from living things on Earth. Kind of the three categories I put my evidences into. I start off with one that everybody can understand, that is the population of the Earth. This article, July 99, says, "Last weekend, the world's population topped 6 billion. Now, 6 billion is a lot of people. You'll find, if you look back in the 1999 newspapers, you'll find about 8 or 9 different dates where they claim this happened. You know, nobody knows for sure when the Earth got 6 billion people, obviously. National Geographic said it happened in October. This one says July. It doesn't matter. The fact is, there's probably about 6 billion people on the planet. In 1985, there were 5 billion people on the planet. I went to the University of West Florida and got several books. I forget the name of the one, Population, Encyclopedia of Population, I think was the name of it, at the University of West Florida. But any good library will have books about population. It's what they deal with. How many people are here? How fast is the population growing? It's all statistics from different countries around the world. And everybody agrees that somewhere in 1985, the world crossed over the 5 billion mark in population. Back in 1800, there was only 1 billion people on the planet. Now think about that. The population has increased 6 times in the last 200 years. If we continue that rate for 200 more years, 600% increase will be a lot of people. The price of property will go way up, right? Now, especially when you stop and consider, only 3% of the Earth's surface is livable. 70% is underwater, for one thing. A whole bunch of it's under ice or desert. I mean, Sahara Desert is huge, much larger than America. Fly out west, and you'll see how much property just is wasted real estate, basically. You couldn't live there. 3% of the population, 3% of the planet is considered to be livable for humans. If before the flood came and it was destroyed, if the pre-flood world was, say, 80% livable, plus you've got much better atmospheric conditions, which we'll get into later when we get into what's on my video number 2 about the Garden of Eden. If you have much more plant life growing and higher oxygen concentration, you can get a more dense population with plenty of food. The Earth was truly built to be inhabited, like the Bible says. I think it's in the book of Psalms. God created it to be inhabited. It could have held a population of hundreds of billions. No problem. This is a huge place. But this Merrill Earth Science textbook, 93 edition, shows the kids that there was about 1 billion in 1810. People argue about when it happened, but roughly around the turn of that century, we crossed over the 1 billion mark. Now, they're saying the Earth is overcrowded. Here's National Geographic, October 99, and it says, on October 12th, the 6 billionth person is going to be born. Like I said, you know, go back to 99, you'll find a lot of arguments of when this happened. But somewhere in 99, we probably crossed over the 6 billion mark. Now, this issue of the population of the Earth was a great motivator for Charles Darwin. I want to pass out this sheet to you here. Everybody take one of these and pass it on down. This is a copy of some of the pages from Henry Morris's book, The Long War Against God. If you want some great supplemental reading, Did we ever order this one to add to our catalog? We should, Dan. This is awesome. You can get it through our ministry. I read this years ago when I just was getting into the creation movement, and this book had a very profound influence on me. He lays out the history of evolutionary thought. Now, I feel like he kind of went backwards. He starts with the present. You know, who's teaching evolution now? More. Okay. He starts with the present and kind of goes backwards in time. So I did a couple of audio tapes on the history of evolution, 2 hours long, on the same kind of information. Who's teaching this stuff? Who influenced who anyway? Where did this idea of evolution come from? And only I started with the Garden of Eden and went the other direction with my audio tapes. So you can still get those tapes from our ministry called the History of Evolution, 2 audio tapes for $3 each if you want those. Or we cover most of the information in here on audio form. You can listen to it in the car.
Can we go back one slide?
Sure.
And because this is a question that I too bad just had about the question mark.
Right.
Over there.
Question above the flood.
According to the graph, it would look to be about 1 billion.
Yeah. Nobody has a clue how many people were here.
Nobody has any
idea. All you can think of is they're probably having much larger families. If you have infinite food supply, no reason to limit the family, and living for 900 years, there's no reason to not have 100 kids per family. Some of the women are thinking, oh, brother, think of all them diapers. What did you say? Now you know why there's more than one wife? I don't know about all that. I had 3. It didn't hurt a thing. I don't know what the population was. I just made up a number. It could have been, some people honestly think there may have been lots more than we have today. Maybe 10 or 20 billion. I don't know. I don't think there's any possible way to tell. You know, you pick a number, because any number you pick is going to be based on several assumptions. So we don't know. The world is certainly not overcrowded, though. Thomas Malthus wrote a book called The Essay on the Principle of Population. In that book, and he talks about it on this paper I passed out, and you can read this later when you go home. Just add that to your repertoire of interesting reading. But Malthus said the population grows geometrically, like it'll double every so many years. And the food supply grows arithmetically. It only grows by adding. You add, you know, a certain percentage or a certain number to the food supply. Now, he's wrong, okay? Malthus was dead wrong. Because if you get more people on the planet, you now have more people available to plant the food. So it's wrong to say the food supply grows in a linear progression and the population grows geometrically. That's simply not true. But Malthus said that in his book. His book was written in the late 1700s, I believe, or early 1800s, had a very profound influence on Darwin. Because Darwin read that and thought, wow, if there's more people born than can possibly survive, then it's really best if the weaker die off and the stronger survive. And you get a person with this kind of mentality. Well, look on the second page of this sheet I passed out here. On slide 2 here. Herbert Spencer, also wrote prolifically on this topic, saying, look, it's really best if the strongest survive and the weaker die off. I got a line underlined for you. Spencer said, if they are not sufficiently competent to live, they die, and it is best they should die. He's the one who coined the phrase survival of the fittest. Now, there's an interesting movie, I'm sure all of you have seen it, where this phrase comes up. He said, are there no poor houses? If they're going to die, let them die and decrease the surplus population. He was talking about Tiny Tim.
Scrooge.
Ebenezer Scrooge, right. Charles Dickens' book, The Christmas Carol. When you understand, that book was written during this time frame of the late 1800s when people had this mentality. Many of the laissez-faire capitalists said, hey, well, if they can't survive, it's their own problem. And we finally had to get lots of labor laws, child labor laws and stuff had to come in because they were working little bitty kids in the factories, you know. He gets his arm cut off, oh, well, get another kid. That really was the mentality because there's too many people anyway. That's a little bit of the mentality they have in China right now. People are expendable. Just throw them away and get another one. You know, there's plenty of them out there. Somebody said if you lined all the Chinese up in a column, 4 people wide, 4 abreast, and started marching them into the sea at a steady march, you would never run out of Chinese. They're being produced faster than that. That's just the Chinese, not the rest of the world. column four, pipe four. I don't know if that's true or who figured that out, but I suspect that probably is. They're being born awfully quick, you know. Laissez-faire capitalists, or we can go off on a long rabbit trail there, but you might want to read this, get this book, Henry Morris's Long War Against God, if you want more on this topic of how the evolution philosophy relied on the idea that there are more people born on the planet than can possibly survive. Now, this is exact opposite of what God told Adam to do. God said, Adam, I want you to be fruitful and multiply and replenish the earth. Have lots of kids. Of course, the devil wants the opposite of that. And I'll show you in a minute why he wants the opposite of that. But Malthus wrote his book on the Essay of Population. Let's make that a quiz question, Heidi. Who was one of the people that influenced Darwin's thinking? We'll have several before this course is over. Thomas Malthus would be the answer. He influenced Darwin's thinking. Darwin thought, because of Malthus's book, there are too many people, and therefore you come into this guy Spencer, who coined the phrase survival of the fittest, which we'll get into later, which, by the way, is not true. Now, the world is not overcrowded. A little bit of facts can undo a lot of erroneous teaching. Jacksonville, Florida is the largest city, land-wise, in America. What they did in Jacksonville has about 800,000 people. They incorporated the entire county into the city limits because they had two governments, a city government and a county government. Well, why pay for sheriffs and police, you know? Why have two separate systems of government? So I'm sure somebody got upset when they lost their job, but they ended up incorporating the entire county limits into the city limits. So when you drive into, I forget the name of the county now, it's not Dade County. Anybody? What? Duval County, yeah. When you drive into the county, you're also in the city. So it's 25 billion square feet in Jacksonville, Florida. Now, that's a huge city. If you've ever driven across it, it's a huge city. But 6 billion people on the planet could all get in there, and everybody have 4 square feet. A little crowded, not as crowded as an elevator gets. But you could probably fit everybody in Jacksonville, Florida twice quite easily. So the world is not overcrowded. I tell people, have you driven across Kansas? Or Wyoming or Montana where I went to school out there? Look, the world's not overcrowded, folks. I just flew out west, and Eric, you flew back. You look out the window and you think, where is everybody? I mean, there's zillions of miles of nothing. There's just nothing down there, folks. The world is definitely not overcrowded. I tell them, if it's overcrowded where you are, move. There's loads of room out there, okay? Remember we're up in South Dakota at the Seth, and what's their last name? Union Center. We stayed at their house several times. Anyway, Rodden. Okay, Rodden. He was talking about buying the property across the street. Remember that? He said, I'm thinking about buying that property across the street. I said, oh, yeah? How much is it? He said, well, I think he said it's 1,000 acres. He wanted to add this lot to his farm. He said, but the guy wants $50 an acre. That's kind of high. $50 an acre. It's hard for us to comprehend that, you know. I was in Hawaii, and it's $500 a square foot to buy property. It's just all a matter of where you are, you know. I was in near downtown Los Angeles talking to the pastor there, and they were talking about buying property to expand their church, and he said it cost them about $1 million an acre to buy property. Just a matter of where you are, okay? They need to buy some of that South Dakota property and move it to Los Angeles. That would solve the problem. But the world is not overcrowded. Anyway, the population growth chart clearly shows that it could have easily started 4,400 years ago. I want you to look at go back to the one that's in the textbook here from Merrill Science. I want you to see what they did with their population growth curve right there. Oh, hang on. They get to the year 1100, which would be the time the Vikings are running around. They chop it off, and it tapers down. Now, they're saying in 7,000 B.C., there were just very few people on the planet, right? And then it kind of drifts back off 500,000 years. Well, this is all imagination. They think that a very small population of a few thousand or a few score thousand people were on the planet for 400,000 or 500,000 years. Wouldn't you have an inbreeding problem in a hurry? You know, you have to marry your first cousin for 10 generations in a row to people start being pretty dumb after a while. Talk about redneck jokes, and they'd have a bunch of them, wouldn't they? This is just pure fantasy. The fact is very simple. The population growth curve tells us man has not been here for billions of years. 4,400 is plenty to account for all the people on the planet. Now, there are several different ways this can be arrived at. Some people use a factor and say there's 2.4 children per family, which I think is the world average or something like that. You can get this number, and it varies greatly from source to source, but you start with 8 people and pick a generation time of 40 years. It's probably actually less than that, but be real generous. Give them a 40-year generation time or something, which means by the time you're 40, you've had your 2.4 kids. Nearly everybody has them way before that. Just about any way you multiply it, you're going to get a population of 5 or 6 billion in just a few thousand years. If it weren't for wars and famines and pestilence and stuff like that, it would be much greater. During the Great Plague in England or Europe in the 1300s, about a third of the entire population died. It's all because they were not obeying God's law about sanitary disposal. We got a whole videotape on the Bible and health. You might want to hit on that. About the verse in Deuteronomy, you know, when thou goest abroad to do thine easement, thou shalt have a paddle upon thy weapon, and turn back and cover that which cometh from thee. In other words, carry a shovel when you go outside to go to the bathroom and bury it. Okay? Of course, in America, we don't have many problems with this because we have, you know, very strict sanitary laws. But in other countries, they have serious problems with diseases because of the lack of sanitation. And in the 1300s, people died by the millions because of the lousy sanitation. They had open sewers running through the street. You don't flush the toilet, you dump the bucket into the sewer, and it, hopefully it flows downhill to somebody downstream.
Yeah.
Like the cowboy humor they saw, don't drink downstream from the herd, you know. And don't squat with your spurs on and all that kind of stuff. But it was just simply disobedience to God's word that caused that. But even though nearly a third of the population died in just a few years' span, the population caught right back up. Just in a short time, it jumped right back up where it was before and surpassed it. Well, for one reason, the infrastructure is already in place. If you've already got houses built, nobody living in them, you can now afford to have more kids and bigger families and easier living conditions. And fields have already been plowed and cleared, you know, so it's much easier to take over new territory for farming. So it didn't affect the population much, surprisingly. You know, probably within 100 years, it was the blip in the scale was totally forgotten. At the time of Jesus Christ, most experts agree there were about 250 million people on the planet, a quarter of a billion. This chart will be in your seminar notebook here that you got with the course, showing this population statistics. Now, you'll find people that argue about the exact number, and there is no way to tell the exact number. There were several kings and leaders who took a census of their population. Why was Jesus born in Bethlehem? They had to go to Bethlehem for the census, right? So it was a common thing to count your people even back then. And people have done research on this and say probably about a quarter of a billion, which is 250 million people at the time of Jesus Christ. Now, if man had really been here for 3 million years, the population would have grown to where we would have about 150,000 people a square inch. And I have some skeptics, believe it or not, that write me letters and get mad at me and say, oh, it would not. It would only be 120,000 per square inch. Well, you numbskull. You're missing the point, okay? The fact is, of course, that would depend on what you're using for a multiplier, you know, how many kids per family, et cetera, et cetera. But the fact is, the world simply is not overcrowded, and it is not billions of years old. The population growth curve demonstrates that. Now, whether we like to understand it or believe it or not, there are an awful lot of folks in our country and around the world that have the evolution philosophy. Now, if evolution is true, then only the strongest have a right to survive. And it really would be best to eliminate the weakest. Now, this is the exact type of stuff Hitler told his people. The strongest should survive. It's really best to get rid of the weaker ones. And obviously, we Germans are the strongest, so therefore we should kill everybody else. That was the mentality that motivated Hitler and Pol Pot and Joseph Stalin and, you know, pick your evil leader through history. Many of them had this philosophy that there are too many people and we need to get rid of the weak ones. The New World Order, and there are many of our American leaders, are involved in a drive toward a one-world government. It's probably led by the elite group called the Council of 300. And we'll get into much more of that later when we get in video number 5, the very politically incorrect one. A few years away at the rate we're going, yes. But if you want to watch video 5, we cover that about the Council of 300. These are the top 300 super smart, super rich people on the planet. They sit around and have their meetings and decide which country needs to have a war to thin down the population, or who's not cooperating with, you know, paying back their loans to us. It's all goes back to money. The love of money is the root of all evil. And we're going to be amazed when we get to heaven and see what really has happened on this planet and see how money tied into just every evil thing that's happened. I'm going off on a lot of rabbit trails there. But they would like to reduce the population to a half billion. What happened? Back in Genesis, this is really the first prophecy. Put that down as a quiz question, Heidi. The first prophecy of the Messiah is in Genesis chapter 3. After the devil, you know, tricked Eve. Now, technically, some people say it wasn't the devil, it was the serpent. It doesn't say it was the devil in this verse. I believe there are some New Testament passages that cross-reference back to that that indicate it was indeed the devil in the serpent. But it doesn't say it in this passage, okay? The serpent, which was Satan, said to Eve, or the Lord said to the serpent, because thou hast done this thing, that is, tricked Eve, thou art cursed above all cattle and above every beast of the field. Upon thy belly shalt thou go, and dust shalt thou eat all the days of thy life. Now let me stop right here. Some people are saying certain large snakes, like boas, I believe, and anacondas maybe, have bones in their abdomen where their hips should be. And this proves they used to walk on land. There's a big deal in the newspaper this week about them finding some fossil of a snake with legs. Several large creatures that do not walk, like a whale and these large snakes, do have bones in that region. But they're nothing to do with walking on land. Those bones are anchor points that different muscles attach to. And without those bones and those muscles, they cannot reproduce. It has nothing to do with walking and having legs. It has to do with making more baby snakes or whales or whatever the case may be. The body is so huge, they have to have the extra muscles and assistance there. So when he said you shall crawl on your belly, I don't know that we can find a scientific justification for this. And I don't know that we could prove the snake used to have legs and lost them other than from the scripture. Maybe if somebody finds something, I'd like to read it. But I would have to take this just as simply miraculous. The Lord said, you know, you're going to crawl on your belly and eat dust the rest of your life. But the next part of the verse is the first prophecy, Genesis 3:15, the first prophecy of the Messiah. The Lord said, I will put enmity, arguments, fights, disagreements, hatred, between thee and the woman, and between thy seed and her seed. It shall bruise thy head, and thou shalt bruise his heel. Now, a bruise on the heel is painful. Do you ever bruise your heel? Step on a stone, man, it hurts for days, doesn't it? But it's not fatal. Seldom is a bruise on the heel fatal. Satan knows full well some seed of the woman is going to bruise his head. So he knows from this prophecy 6,000 years ago, the Lord said, someday a man's going to be born to a woman that's going to be your undoing. And so because he's scared stiff of what God's going to do to him, he's decided to try to frustrate the plans of God by killing or corrupting every human being alive. When we get to the days of Noah, he had just about everybody corrupted, didn't he? A few hundred years later, in the days of the Tower of Babel, just about got them all again. There have been many times down through history where just about everybody was corrupt. Satan's working awful hard, and I think most of his effort is because of this prophecy. He doesn't know who's going to bruise his head. Remember when Herod wanted to kill baby Jesus in Bethlehem? What did he do? He slew all the children. Just kill everybody, 2 years old and under, right? Now, there's a fascinating book, if you want to read something amazing on this story, called the Archco volume. Has anybody ever heard of that? The Archco. Have you read any of that, Dan? Oh, it's awesome. What happened? This guy back in 1820 or something, some guy in Germany, decided, hey, if Jesus was such an important figure, surely there were other records about him besides the Bible. So he began researching all sorts of ancient records and found court documents. For instance, Herod got in trouble for killing all the children in Bethlehem. He was called into question. What gives you the authority to kill all these kids anyway, you know? And it was quite a big deal in that country over what Herod did. Now, that's not recorded in the Bible, but it is recorded in other books. And this guy found it and put it into this little book called the Archco volume. Very fascinating reading. When the high priest sent some people to interview the shepherds after the annunciation of Jesus going to be born, you know. And the shepherds described what they saw in there, of the music rolling up and down the hills, and they were so filled with joy, they didn't know if they should cry or shout, so they did both at the same time, you know. just amazing reading about that kind of stuff. Where they sent some people to interview Jesus when he was 26 years old. And the guy came back and said, I think Jesus is avoiding me. Every place I go, they say, well, he was here, but he left. It's like he knows when I'm coming. So they interviewed Joseph and Mary instead. And they describe what Joseph and Mary were like. They say Mary was short and plump and a very pleasant woman. Joseph was big and ugly and dumb, basically. And Joseph was disappointed in Jesus because he expected him to be a king and he thought, I'm going to get rich off this deal, you know. And it turned out Jesus had no intention of being a king and Joseph was very disappointed in him. It's neat just to read this from a secular perspective if you want to get more on that. But anyway, Herod slew all the children in Bethlehem. Many people have the evolution philosophy as the foundation for their thinking. And it does this just like it did for Charles Darwin. The thinking is, we're nothing but animals. And if there's too many people, we need to get rid of some. All over the country, they have laws on how many deer you can shoot, right? Why do they have limits? Somebody's full-time job is trying to figure out how many deer are in the woods and how many can the woods support. How many trees are there? How much grass is there? How much food to eat? And if, you know, we need to eliminate, you know, 20% of the herd this year, and therefore they issue permits to kill X number of bucks or does. They're trying to maintain the population in ratio with the food supply, which is not necessarily good or bad. That's just the way it is. But a lot of folks would like to eliminate people. Jacques Cousteau was an evolutionist. Go back and watch any of Jacques Cousteau's movies or books, things that he did, and you'll see evolution all through there. He was a strong believer in this philosophy. He said, in order to stabilize world population, we must eliminate 350,000 people a day. That's at the United Nations Development Fund for Women. We want to develop the world. We've got to eliminate 350,000 people every day in order to save the planet. Have you seen those bumper stickers? You know, save Mother Earth. The Earth is not your mother. Okay, but that's the mentality. Charles Worcester said when they were arguing about banning DDT as a pesticide. Now, there's no question DDT is harmful. You know, I think that's the one that thins the eagle's eggs and the bird sits on them and they crack and therefore, the baby dies. But one of the arguments in favor of banning DDT was people are the cause of all the problems. We have too many of them. We need to get rid of some of them. And this ban of DDT is as good a way as any. Because if we don't use DDT, there'll be more pests, more mosquitoes, and more people will die. That's one of the parts of the philosophy behind the arguments for banning DDT. This quote says, the world has cancer and the cancer is man. You'll find a lot of people, if you read articles in the newspaper or watch TV carefully, the mentality is that there are too many people, we need to get rid of some of them. The weaker should be killed off. Ted Turner, president of CNN, Communist News Network, I tell everybody. He said a total world population of 250 to 300 million people, a 95% decline would be ideal. Okay, Ted, you first. Everybody thinks somebody else ought to have to die, right? So we can have more room. Every group thinks, of course, they're the superior one. Hitler thought it was the Germans. The Japanese thought it was the Japanese that are superior. They really thought they are the superior race and it's their duty to rule the world. So we need to go kill everybody. They don't think that now. I at least hope they don't. But they did at a time. There's a lot of interesting articles going around about Jane Fonda becoming a Christian now. Now, she's often referred to as Hanoi Jane. You need to understand why. If you write me a remind me, I can email you the letter that I have of some of the prisoners who were in Vietnam that when Jane Fonda came over, she was demonstrating against the war. Her dad, Henry Fonda, the movie star, and Jane Fonda's a movie star too, she had she had gone to North Vietnam to tour the prison camps. The prisoners heard, wow, an American's coming. We've got to get word to our family that we're still alive. So a whole bunch of these prisoners lined up to shake Jane Fonda's hand. They wrote their Social Security number on a little strip of paper. And when they shook hands, they handed it to her. She smiled, took the paper, walked down the line. This wad of paper's getting bigger and bigger in her hand. When she got to the end, she didn't even look at it. She went over to the commandant of the camp and said, Commandant, these men are trying to get a message out. You may want to deal with this. So after she left, every one of those men got a beating. Four men died from the beating. Were killed for trying to get their, let their loved ones know I'm still alive. So she has been referred to as Hanoi Jane. Now, if she got saved, great. God can forgive anybody. And God can use her in a great way in His kingdom. What she did was wrong, and I hope she, you know, if she's a Christian, I'm sure she realizes that. But we've all got things we've done wrong, too. But that's why she's referred to as Hanoi Jane, just so you know, since one of the purposes of this class is so Eric knows why I say everything I say, right? Okay. Prince Philip of the World Wildlife Fund said, "If I could be reincarnated, I would wish to return to Earth as a killer virus to lower human population levels." This will be a little bit of a rabbit trail. I don't want to chase too far, but when it comes to viruses, there are all sorts of things being manufactured in laboratories purposely to lower the human population. There is some really good evidence, and you might want to do some research on this, and don't quote me as saying I can prove that it's true, but there's some really good evidence that the AIDS virus was manufactured intentionally in the Army Laboratory in Maryland and tested by putting it into the population in Africa in the guise of putting it in as vaccines. "Oh, we're here to help you from your smallpox. Come here, let me give you a shot." Now, the people that did it probably didn't know what they were doing, that they had tainted vaccines that would, yes, it'll cure the smallpox, but it introduces AIDS into the system. And now, I forget the percentage, but it's a really high percentage of Africa has AIDS. One of the plans is to depopulate Africa and make it a big game preserve. Get rid of all the people so all the animals can have their world back. It goes back to a philosophy of evolution which says man is expendable, you know, and it's totally opposite of what the scripture says. This ultimately originates from Satan. On the subject of vaccines, I don't chase the rabbit too far. I'm not afraid to. But you might want to get that book about vaccinations. You might want to call Dr. Tyler. If you get my videotape, The Bible and Health, we deal with this quite a bit. Dr. Tyler is a chiropractor in Washington, Missouri, a good friend of mine and a brilliant man when it comes to nutrition. He has all sorts of articles and books and information on vaccinations. Many people are claiming, and I think they're probably right, that probably every case of SIDS, sudden infant death syndrome, where baby just dies, they call it crib death, you know, baby just dies in the crib. Many people, I've heard them say, every case of SIDS is caused by vaccinations. Dr. Tyler, on the video, The Bible and Health, he goes through all sorts of stats and charts and, you know, documentation of where this information is coming from, that Alzheimer's disease is probably caused by vaccinations because they use such a high dose of formaldehyde as part of the carrier for the vaccination. And they give you a vaccine they're putting is formaldehyde and it's high in aluminum. And for years, people have known that aluminum builds up in the system and is one of the key causes of Alzheimer's disease. And they keep looking for, you know, how are we getting this aluminum in our system? Is it the cooking pots we're using? Is it the aluminum coffee pots? Is it, you know, aluminum things we're cooking with or aluminum cans for Coca-Cola? Well, the amount you get from a Coca-Cola can, the aluminum that gets into your Coke, is real close to zero. This gigantic doses of it put right into your bloodstream through the vaccinations. And, of course, now if I were the devil and I wanted to kill everybody on the planet, I would have all sorts of ways going at the same time to accomplish my goal. I'd try to destroy people physically, emotionally, spiritually, financially, every way possible. It's a multifaceted attack on us. He's after us. He hates us. He hates everybody. Now, he's got some of these super rich folks thinking they should reduce the population to 500 million. What they don't know is when he's done using them, he's going to kill them also. They think we need to get it to 500 million. He thinks we should get it to zero. He's trying to avoid the fulfillment of that prophecy. The seed of the woman is going to bruise his head. Now, when Jesus died on the cross, that was a bruise to the heel. He thought it was fatal, but he came back alive, didn't he? The death on the cross was probably the bruise on the heel, and someday we're going to see Satan cast into hell. Outside of Elberton, Georgia, between Atlanta and Greenville, 7 miles north on Highway 77, did you go by there and see those there? Who was it? Jeremy. I performed the wedding for Jeremy out here in the yard. He went by and saw him. I got a picture of Jeremy standing by the Georgia Guidestones. The Georgia Guidestones, here they are right here. There's Jeremy standing at the bottom. These are huge granite slabs set up. The reason they chose this place, the Cherokee Indians used to own this property. They called it, I forget the Cherokee name, but they called it the center of the universe. Probably everybody thinks where they live is the center of the universe, but the Cherokee Indians thought this was the center of the universe. And if you look at the top left-hand corner, it says this is set up by Arthur C. Christian, a pseudonym. Pseudo means false. pseudonym is a false name. Some guy came to town with a pocket full of money, went to the granite quarry and said, I want these slabs cut, I want this written on here, and I want you to put it up over here. Paid for the whole thing and disappeared. He called himself Arthur C. Christian. And he admits it's a pseudonym. This is not my name. Lots of folks have researched this and come to the conclusion this was a Masonic lodge. The guys who were behind this were in the Masonic lodge. Now, certainly not all Masons are bad. We'll get into more on the Masons later. The average Mason doesn't have a clue what he's in. He thinks he's in a do-gooders club, and they do an awful lot of good. It's only those that get to the top finally figure out we're in a satanic organization. And it really is satanic, but they won't know that. And they purposely try to bring in Christians into their organization, pastors, just so they get a good image for the community. Because there's a secret club inside that secret club. And the average Mason doesn't know about the secret club on the inside. But it's a, anyway, I can't prove it's set up by the Masons. This is what the research has shown. They say that the Masonic, some Masons sponsored to have this done. But on the Georgia Guidestones in 12 languages, it says, commandment number one, maintain humanity under 500 million. That's a half a billion. Now, wait a minute. There's already 6 billion on the planet. How are you going to maintain it under a half a billion? Well, it looks to me like somebody has to go, right? A whole bunch of somebodies have to go. If you want to see all 10 of the Ten Commandments for the New Age, they're listed on RadioLiberty.com, is a great website, and also, I forgot the www, but CuttingEdge.org is a good website that deals with this type of thing, of these guys who have plans for their new world order. In the center, there's a slot. I'll back it up here. You can see right above Jeremy's head, right beside Jeremy, there's a black line there. That's a slot cut in the granite. On June 21st, at summer solstice, when the sun's as high as it's going to get above the equator, it shines through that slot at high noon and focuses on a dot down on a piece of concrete or something. I don't know what's on the dot, but it's all the symbolism stuff, sort of like Stonehenge and, you know, the Great Pyramid and all this same kind of stuff. But there's the Georgia Guidestones. If you're ever driving through there, Eric, stop and see that. So get your picture next to it. We'll put you there. The population today, though, is about 6 billion. It's over 6 billion. And it indicates man has not been here for millions of years. So this is the first one of the evidences I use that the Earth is not billions of years old. The population simply doesn't support the idea. Keep in mind, the evolutionists must have billions of years, and it isn't available. So let's take a little mini quiz. It won't count for a grade. What was the population in 1800? 1 billion. The time of Christ, what was it? 250 million. It's right there on the chart here. When did we cross over the 5 billion mark? 1985, right. Nobody argues about these dates. 1962, 3 billion. Now, this is an interesting thought. This certainly couldn't be proven, but it very well could be true. How many of the people born in 1930 are still alive? Quite a few, right? They're 70 years old. It has been said, I don't know that you could prove it, but it has been said there could be more people alive today than there are people that are dead today. The total, cum total population of the world ever that's lived and died could be less than 6 billion. I don't know, but that's an interesting thought. When you stop and put that together, say, wow. Talk about an opportunity for the mission field. We have more people to reach now than ever before. Certainly more. We can reach more now than Paul did and Peter did. And we have better ways to do it. You know, you can preach on TV and it goes all over the world or via the Internet. And I think we ought to use every available means to reach every available person. Okay. Take a couple more facts here about the population, about the age of the universe, and then we'll quit for the day. The galaxies, the stars are generally in big clusters called galaxies. What galaxy do we live in? The Milky Way galaxy, right? Which is why if you look in the sky a certain direction, you kind of look through the side of our own galaxy, and it's kind of all white, like a milky stripe across there, because it's zillions of stars. The stars in the middle are going faster. Now, the star itself, you can't tell if it's spinning or not, but it's moving in a circle around the center of its galaxy. The stars in the middle go faster than the stars at the outside. So the galaxy is slowly winding up. The center ones are going to go faster, and it's going to spiral, it's going to twist itself in, and that's what causes the spiral arms. But this can only happen for a short time. Can't happen for billions and billions of years, because if the stars were all moving different speeds, pretty soon you wouldn't have these arms anymore. It would be just one big, smooth, homogeneous mass. You might want to get the book In the Beginning by Walt Brown. He gives the details on this and references of where you can find the proof of this. Page 23 and page 30, he deals with a lot on this. That's a fascinating book. Now, Walt Brown doesn't agree with me on a couple things, on the canopy theory and stuff like that. I'll straighten him out someday. But he's just a brilliant man, and it's really an awesome book. I'd recommend that. Yes,
sir. Do you think the book In the Beginning is better than the other book?
It's A Young World by John Morris? It's different. They're both good. If you look in your seminar notebook on page, we're talking about the age of the Earth. On page 11, 12, 13 is where I talk about the evidence from the age of the Earth. Page 11 has the sources. If you want to read good books on this topic, I've got 12 of them listed here. All of these books deal with the question, how old is the universe? And if you want to go down deep, stay down long, come up dry, this is some of the stuff you want to read right here. I would say Henry Morris's book, Scientific Creationism, would be a great one I would start with. If you want a simpler one, though that's not too hard. The very last one, John Morris, A Young Earth, we sell that here through our ministry, or you can get it through ICR or Master Books. Walt Brown, In the Beginning, number 11, is a great one. If you could only pick a few, I'd pick those three. Probably next would be number 4, Paul Ackerman, It's a Young World After All. That's a really good one. Those are some that you might want to get just to gain more information so you can document what you're saying on this topic. What I do on my slides here, I put other documentation at the bottom so I can just keep on talking and speed up. And if somebody has a question, well, they can look it up for themselves, a reference at the bottom. So the galaxies also, there's another thing I don't mention here, but I do in the seminar notebook. Not only are the galaxies themselves spinning and closing in tighter and the arms should be disappearing, but the clusters of galaxies, you got 10 galaxies all clustered together. Together is a relative term. They're a long ways apart. But they're spreading out. The galaxy clusters are expanding, which proves they haven't been moving for billions of years. I'm real cautious. Eric, in the early days when I was doing my seminar, I would quote a number, and I would say, this proves the galaxies have to be less than 1 billion years old. And some of the skeptics who don't seem to see the forest because the trees are in the way, you know, they will say, oh, it's not 1 billion, it's 1.5 billion. You can't do your math. And they would pick on the number and still miss the whole point. So I'm real cautious now to not give specific numbers when I go through these proofs of a young Earth. And nothing proves the Earth is 6,000 years old. Except the Bible. That's the only way you're going to get 6,000 is from this book. Now, there's ways you can limit it to less than billions, but the only way you're going to get 6,000 is right here. Red stars, they call them a red giant star. Now, I have to stop right here and say, you get the biggest telescope in the world, you look at the closest star, you cannot tell how big it is. All you see is a dot. So I think it's probably true that red stars are larger, but we don't know that for positively. All the astronomers say the red stars are larger. How do you know that? Well, we think it's larger. Well, okay, maybe it is, and it probably is, but I'd be careful about being dogmatic about that. You cannot see the size of any of these stars. You can't even see a star. You don't see the surface, I mean, like you see the sun with the flames leaping off. Get the biggest telescope in the world, look at the closest star, which is Alpha Centauri, and all you see is a dot. You get a bigger telescope, you see the dot better. That's about it. When they put the Hubble up, somebody said, are you worried when they put the Hubble up they're going to prove evolution? I said, oh, no, I can tell you exactly what they're going to see with the Hubble. They said, what? I said, they're going to see more stars. That's what they did, too. It's neat to go out at night and look at part of the sky, let your eyes focus on it, and all of a sudden more stars start appearing, and then get a telescope and put it up there. And it's like, wow. Things that you thought were just a few stars, all of a sudden now that little dot is an entire galaxy of billions of stars. It's unreal. I've got a video clip I need to add in here about, all right, I'll put it in part 7 probably. Somebody did that. They took a video through a telescope as they were zooming in. And what looked like just a few stars, all of a sudden these stars became entire clusters of galaxies. And it just blow your mind. It's so beautiful, you know. I hope when we get to heaven, the Lord allows us to travel at the speed of thought. All you got to do is think about being somewhere. I'm glad students can't do it now because they'd be in and out of the room all the time, you know. I think I'm at the beach. Hey, come on back. Of course, at the speed of thought, some people would go pretty slow, come to think of it. But you know a few of those. Yeah? Okay, textbooks say that red giant stars slowly evolve into a white dwarf star. Now, it seems to be true that red stars do change to white stars after a while. And they've got a whole series set up of how this happens. And if you take an astronomy course, they'll go through all the go down deep, stay down long kind of stuff on how stars burn up a certain amount of heat and they get rid of a certain amount of critical mass and then they collapse on themselves and expand. And they've got all this stuff all theorized. I wouldn't argue with them. Maybe it's all true. I don't know. I don't think they know either. However, they're going to say to go from a red star to a white star takes hundreds of billions of years. Or billions of years. This textbook says, if you look in the lower left-hand corner, it may take 100 billion years, or 10 billion years, or just a few billion years. The average-sized star, like our sun, would be in the middle there. They're going to say it takes, in 10 billion years, it'll change to a white dwarf. And they've got it all figured out how the sun, when it burns up a certain amount of fuel, it no longer has enough gravity to hold it together. So it'll swell up, like a marshmallow does when you get it hot over a fire. When it swells up, then it collapses back on itself, boom, and turns into a little tiny white dwarf star. And then that explosion, all that process is where the nova and supernova comes in. The star explodes. And they say the sun is going to swell up as big as the Earth's orbit, and we're all going to be fried. It'll end about 10 billion years. Oh, you better get a life insurance policy now, you know. anyway, I doubt that's going to happen. But the stars do change. And yet, all of the ancient astronomers, if you go back and read the records, yes?
You don't doubt that it's going to happen.
It's not going to happen, period. God's heaven and earth, well, heaven and earth shall pass away, but my word shall not pass away. So maybe he will let that happen that way. Interesting verse when it says the sun is going to scorch men in the book of Revelation. They'll be scorched with the fervent heat. Some Bible scholars will say, see, that's the beginning of a supernova. The sun is swelling. But could be, or it could be the atmospheric conditions are different, you know. Just changing the atmosphere would scorch everybody here. You don't have to make the sun larger. Go to Sahara Desert, you want to get scorched, you know. 130 degrees, that'll scorch you right now. This idea about red stars changing to white stars is probably true. But all of the ancient astronomers referred to Sirius, which is the brightest star in the sky. If you go out on a cloudless night, other than the planets, which appear even brighter because some of them are, you know, so much closer. The brightest star is the star Sirius. Now, it's not the closest star. It's the brightest star. Everybody referred to Sirius as a red star. The ancient astronomers did. Today, it's a white dwarf star. This information comes from the book, It's a Young World After All. It's a Young World by Paul Ackerman, which we have, I believe, right, Dan? It's out of print, isn't it? But we still have some left. It's back in print. Okay. Yeah, I've talked to Paul Ackerman on the phone several times. He said there's a couple things he'll change about the book next time that he's found out are not quite accurate, but 98% of it is really great. One atheist wrote me a very nasty letter about my mention of Sirius being a white star. And he said, don't you know Sirius is a binary star? There are two of them going around. I wrote back and said, yeah, and they're both white. So what's your point? It appears to be a binary star, two stars spinning around each other, and they're both white stars. So, just so you know that in case somebody questions you on that. Yes, it's binary, but they're both white. Okay, let's move in now. Instead of from stars, though there's lots of evidence from space that the universe is not billions of years old, let's move in just to our solar system. Two different words you need to be careful, Eric, not to confuse, is the universe and the solar system. Solar system is just our nine planets and the sun. The universe would be everything, all of the stars and planets, etc. Jupiter is a huge planet, but it's cooling off. Estimates are that it's losing its heat twice as fast as it gets it from the sun. Let's see. My very extravagant mother just sent us 90 parakeets, was the way to memorize the planets in order. Mercury, Venus, Earth, Mars, Jupiter, Saturn, Uranus, Neptune, Pluto. And if you want to memorize the distance to the planets, which I made my students do in Earth science class, just to get a few of them, you can do it as an astronomical unit. It's a quick way to do it. Mercury is the closest one. It's 0.39. Venus is 0.7. Earth is 1. The distance from the Earth to the Sun, 93 million miles, is called an astronomical unit, AU. We'll get into that more of that later. Mars, I believe, is 1.5. Jupiter, which we're talking about here, if I recall, is 5 astronomical units. That means it's 5 times farther away from the Sun than we are. If you're on Jupiter, the Sun would look real small and would supply you with very little heat. Even Mars at 1.5 astronomical units is real chilly. 50% farther away than we are. These 4 planets are called the inner planets, and if you put it on a scale, or you can do it with a ruler, 0.3, 0.7, 1, 1.5, 5. The next one, I believe, is 9. It goes clear out to 39, which is Pluto. 39 astronomical units away, which is why Pluto wasn't discovered till just recently. You got to have a really good telescope. And even then, they only noticed there might be another one because one of the inner planets was moving a little bit. In its orbit, it kind of bumped out of orbit. They said, oh, something must be pulling it. And that's how they detected Pluto, because another planet wasn't quite in the exact same spot where it's supposed to be based upon normal orbit. Who cares? Okay, you can get into that in Earth science class. But the point is, Jupiter's way out there, 5 times farther away than we are, and gets very little heat from the Sun, and yet Jupiter is still hot. Now, how can you keep losing heat for billions of years? Wouldn't you pretty soon be cooled off? We cover in here evidence from space on page 11. If you want to read more references about this, you can document it. For instance, item number 9, Saturn's rings are unstable, they're breaking up. Jupiter and Saturn are cooling off rapidly. They're losing heat. You can see the reference here. Reference number 5, page 26. That would be from Edward Blick's book, Scientific Analysis of Genesis. Also, reference number 4, page 43. That would be from Ackerman's book, It's a Young World After All. Anyway, the way this works in the seminar notebook is so that you can look up the reference and the page number. It's kind of written right in here. It's a little different way to footnote, I know, but it's very fast and efficient. That's the way I use. It's not probably the standard way, which I very seldom have cared what the standard way is for anything. So, right, Dan? That's true. So the references here, that's how it works with your notebook. Jupiter has a little moon called Ganymede. It's not really that little. It's about the same size as the planet Mercury. So this Ganymede is one of the, I don't know how many there are now, maybe 20 moons around Jupiter. It's a lot. One of the moons, called Ganymede, as one of the Voyager's space probes went through it, the Jupiter probe, said there's a a very strong magnetic field. And all they can figure is a magnetic field has to be produced by the inside core being hot. And to have something that small be that hot, when it's that far away from the Sun, it's surprising. A smaller body cools off faster than a larger body. The reason for that is, without going too far down this rabbit hole, your surface area increases in proportion to your volume as you decrease in size. Did we erase all that from the last time? Nope. Here. Okay, if you have a little cube that is 1 inch, 1 by 1 by 1, 1 inch cube, it has 1 cubic inch of volume. 1 cubic inch. The surface area, how many square inches of surface would it take to build that cube? 6. It has 6 square inches of surface area. Now watch this. So my ratio is 1 to 6, right? Now let's make our cube twice as big. 2 inches by 2 inches by 2 inches. What's the volume? 2 times 2 times 2 is 8. What's our surface area? 4 on each side. There are 6 sides. 24. What's our ratio? 1 to 3. See what happened? This is a very important concept to understand, because as you get smaller, If we made a cube that was 1/2 inch on each side, you would have 1/2 times 1/2, which is 1/4 inch on each side for the surface. 6 of those, you have 6/4 inch. That's 1 1/4 inches. Let's make this say 1/2. Oh, I'm sorry. This is for 1 inch. This is for 2 inch. Let's go to 1/2 inch cube. I probably should put it above so it doesn't confuse people conceptually. Volume, surface area. If we go to 1/2 inch cube, we now have a surface area of 1 1/4. And who's got a calculator? 0.5 times 0.5 times 0.5. Or 1/8, which is okay, we'll just keep it as fractions. It'll be easier to work with. Okay, 1/8 to 1 1/4 is a ratio of 1 to 12. Now look what's happening here. We have very little volume and a whole lot of surface. As a creature gets smaller and smaller, like an ant, pretty soon they have so much surface and so little volume, they fall out of a tree, hit the ground and walk off. Elephant falls out of the tree, bam! Right? This problem right here is one of the reasons elephants are wrinkled. Because they have so much body mass, they have to get wrinkles in the skin in order to radiate the heat away. The other reason they're wrinkled is because they're very difficult to iron. But as an animal gets larger and larger, the surface area to volume ratio becomes a serious problem. Now, this will be important later, Eric, when we get into this about insects. Since insects don't breathe through their mouth like we do, they absorb oxygen through the skin. Every cell in their body needs oxygen, but as your surface area to volume ratio diminishes, you just simply can't get enough oxygen to supply it because you don't have enough skin. The only way you can get a huge insect is to increase the air pressure. There's a maximum size insects can get based upon the air pressure. So one of the proofs we'll get into later, that the world before the flood was a lot different, is the fossils we find of giant insects. This is a good proof that something was different. Sometime in the past, there must have been a lot more air pressure because of this surface area to volume ratio problem. Okay, enough on that rabbit trail. I've always wanted to chase it in my seminar. I never got time to. No, we did. Okay, Ganymede is a large planet. I mean, it's a large moon. But compared to Jupiter, it's real tiny. Now, because it is smaller, it has really a greater surface area to volume ratio problem than Jupiter does. So it should lose heat even faster than Jupiter. One of the reasons, if you want to cool something off, you got a hot piece of, you know, a potato, for instance, you break it up and spread it out. All you're doing is increasing the surface exposure. When you want to get something to dissolve faster in water, you break it up. Drop in a chunk of ice into your glass, or take the ice cube and crush it and drop it in. Same amount of ice, the ice cube will last longer and dissolve slower than the crystals, the small pieces, because they now more surface is exposed to be dissolved or whatever. It's a principle you can use all through science. Who cares? Point is, Ganymede is still hot, and it shouldn't be. And they admitted in the newspaper article here about Ganymede should have cooled solid billions of years ago. Why does it still have a magnetic field? So what they've done over this Ganymede problem, when the space probe sent this data back and said, look, Ganymede has a strong magnetic field. The scientists start with the assumption, well, we know it's billions of years old, so how did this happen? The thought never enters their mind that maybe it's not billions of years old. So they're busy looking for ways to keep their evolution, age of the Earth necessity, you know, billions of years. They have to keep that. What they've said is maybe Ganymede, maybe something passed by Jupiter, and the gravitational pull of this passing star or whatever pulled Ganymede in closer to Jupiter. And because it was closer, the gravity of Jupiter was stronger, so it's pumping it and it's squeezing the surface, and that's what increased the temperature. And then, poof, it popped back out to its orbit where it is now. They've got to come up with all these wild ideas just to try to save the one concept that the universe is billions of years old. So when you read the articles on the web about me, and there's some really interesting ones, some of these scoffers, they write whole books, you know, answering Hovind's, you know, young earth arguments. It's hilarious to read. When you stop it, they think because they talked, they answered the question. This is a rule teachers soon learn. The longer the kid's essay answer is, the less he knows about it. How many of you ever did one of those essay questions where you tried to snow the teacher, you know? You don't have a clue what's going on, so you just talk, and pretty soon they get tired of reading and think, well, he must know what he's talking about, you know, give him an A. And some of these scoffers went to school and never did learn to overcome that problem, and so they write these long diatribes about me, and they'll say, don't you know that Ganymede is still hot because it got sucked in and was pumped by Jupiter's gravity and then flung back out, you know? Well, you can believe all that if you want. The fact is, it's hot. The fact is, you've got to come do all sorts of mental gymnastics to come up with an answer for this when there is another obvious possible answer. It's not billions of years old. That's the simplest, most logical answer. It's not billions of years old. But I will tell you, to everyone I'm going to give you here, they do have what they claim is an answer to it. But you got to just read it slowly and carefully, and you realize how dumb most of them are. They just are silly. Yes, sir? Right. Yeah, the circular planets, yeah. The orbits of the planets going epicycles, I know. People get a pet theory and they just try to hang on to it desperately. We probably all do that. Okay, everybody's blind to their own, you know, problems, but they certainly do that with evolution. They will fight desperately to keep the Earth and universe being billions of years old because otherwise your frog can't turn into your prince, you know, and you got to have that. Saturn and four planets have rings around them. Saturns are the most visible. We saw them the other night with the telescope. Remember that out there? And it's just like a 2-inch telescope, a spotting scope for the target range. We could see the Saturn's rings. It's really incredible. Saturn's rings are made of rock and ice. Saturn's rings are beautiful as you get up close to them, and there have been several probes have gone by and photographed them, even gone through the rings and verified they are indeed rock and ice. Extremely cold ice. Now, the reason they're in a ring on the equator, if you had a basketball covered with water and you started spinning it, what would happen to the water? It'd fly off at the equator, wouldn't it? That's the fastest moving point, right? So Saturn is spinning, and you can tell where the equator is on Saturn by where the rings are. Four planets have these rings. Saturn's are the most visible, these ice and rock rings around them. But the rings are unstable. They're moving around. Different moons are going around Saturn, and some people call them shepherding moons. Each of these moons has a gravitational pull. So you got these moons going around these rings also, and they're pulling these crystals of ice and rock out of their orbit and then dropping them back in. As the moon passes, it loses its gravitational pull. Well, how long can that process stay going and the rings still stay intact? You can't just keep messing it up continually and have it still stay intact. It's a known fact, and there's good information about this in Walt Brown's book, In the Beginning. Got the references right there, page 29 and page 69. He goes through all the details on, you know, the Saturn's rings. The fact is, they're unstable, they're expanding. They can't be billions of years old. So, the evolutionist looks at this, they do all the studies and say, wow, the rings are moving, probably less than 10,000 years old. Then they'll come along and say, see, this proves something nearly hit Saturn 10,000 years ago, got shattered, and got caught in the spin and became the rings. Maybe so. But maybe it's because it's not billions of years old. So their answer to this is a moon or something came by and shattered into fragments, and it's now the rings. And yes, it is less than 10,000 years old. But that doesn't prove Saturn is. That's what they'll say. I had another point on that I was going to make, and I forgot it. In my video number 6, the Hovind theory, where I cover about an ice meteor possibly being the cause of the flood here on Earth, if an ice meteor, and outer space is full of these big comets that are super cold chunks of ice and snow, if one of those came and hit the Earth, or just came near the Earth, and or shattered and came through our solar system like a shotgun, fragments of broken ice crystals, that may be where the rings of Saturn came from. They may indeed have been caused, the four planets, plus the craters on the other planets, plus the flood here on Earth, might have all been caused in a giant solar catastrophe. I mean, a solar system catastrophe. an ice meteor is, in my opinion, the most logical candidate. Now, I call it the Hovind theory because I don't know for sure. I look at all the evidence. Hey, seems to fit. I tell people, if you have a key and it fits the lock, that doesn't prove that's the key for the lock, but it could be, right? And if you have a theory and it fits all the observations, well, maybe you have the right theory. Doesn't prove you do, but it's better than if your key does not fit the lock. Now you know you have the wrong theory for sure. Evolution, it doesn't fit any of the locks. Okay, let's come in a little closer now. We can look at our planets in space. We can also look at the fact that so many of these planets have really good orbits, almost perfectly circular orbits, you know, egg-shaped a little bit, but amazingly good orbits. And the planets themselves are amazingly round. The moon, for instance, is just almost perfectly a round ball. It is spinning so slow, there's very little bulge at the equator. The Earth is spinning a lot faster, and there's about a 20-mile bulge. The equatorial diameter is 20 miles farther than the polar diameter. If you spin a basketball real fast, it'll flatten out like a frisbee. You'd have to get it really fast. But the Earth is spinning once a day, which flattens it out a little bit, pulls the poles in, sucks the equator out, about a 20-mile difference, which really is nothing compared to 8,000-mile Earth. You know, from space, you can't see that 20-mile difference. The moon is, I don't know what it is, like 1 or 2 or 3 mile difference. It's very little. The moon is spinning once every 29 days. It also goes around the Earth once every 29 days, which is why we never see the other side. As it's turning, it's always facing us. You know, they never see the other side of the moon unless they go out there and take a picture with a rocket or something. But the moon is going around the Earth once every 29 days. The moon is almost perfectly smooth. The theories of how we got the planets and the moon all fall apart. There's the most common theory, I think, probably the most common theory now, is called the accretion theory. They will say the planets formed after the Big Bang, all these particles flew out, and then they all started drawing together because of gravity, and the more mass you get, the stronger gravity becomes, and they start sucking in particles, and pretty soon, you know, you got a planet. Well, you'd have a clump of rock stuck together. What's going to cause it to melt into this perfectly smooth ball? And so their answer to that one is, well, meteors hit, this supplies heat and energy. And that's what melted it. Well, there are some marks on the moon, but the moon is in an almost perfectly circular orbit around the Earth. And it's almost perfectly round. I mean, I don't think that's going to form by an accretion of particles over billions of years. If you want to believe that, that's fine, but that's not science, that's religion. That's what they believe. And that'll be their answer to this one. But the moon goes around the Earth, but the moon is gradually getting farther away. We're slowly losing the moon. It's leaving us. The numbers vary. Now, people argue about this. There's good articles about this here, the Impact article from Institute for Creation Research. If you want to get some fascinating reading, these little Impact articles, they're just one-page articles. They're 10 cents a piece, and they started them in 1974, I believe. And they're up to number like 350 now. So for $35... you can get all of the back issues. And it is just amazing reading. I mean, that's an entire course in itself, just reading all the Impact articles that they've put out for the last 25 years. This one is Impact number 110, published in 1982, August of 82. And you can still, I think you can get some of these on ICR's website, icr.org. But they go through by Thomas Barnes, was a University of Texas, El Paso. I've spoken there twice, done debates at University of Texas, El Paso. Matter of fact, last month. He was a physics professor there. He was a young Earth creationist. And they didn't like him because they didn't want a University of Texas professor who believed the Bible. They tried all sorts of things to, you know, ridicule him. He's now, if he's still alive, he's probably in his 80s. But I've talked to him a couple times on the phone. Really gracious man. He wrote this article 20 years ago about the young age for the moon and the Earth, showing that because the moon is getting farther away, that means, obviously, it used to be closer. Now, if you bring the moon in closer, you create a problem, because the moon is what causes the tides. Now, I don't worry about the tides here, even though I'm in Pensacola, because we're 60 feet above sea level. But the folks along the beach worry about the tides, right? I've been to the Bay of Fundy, and where the greatest tidal change, we were there too, weren't you? The greatest tidal change ever recorded during what's called a spring tide, when the moon and the sun both line up and they're both pulling on the water, it was 103 feet difference from low tide to high tide. The water comes rushing in and out of that bay so fast, they surf in front of it. There'll be a wall of water 4 feet high. You can go up there and pay $5 and get in this big rubber raft. You were right there at the place, weren't you? And they actually, you sit for 3 or 4 hours. It pushes you upriver. And this wall of water and this raft, just like going through the rapids. First you go out there and you sit in the mud, wait for the wall of water to come. And then they get a bus and bring you in the raft all the way back down to where you started. And here's your $5. We should go up there to the Bay of Fundy. Mom and I, a few months ago, were in Alaska, and we got to see the second highest tides, which is where Anchorage, Alaska is, which is where it got its name, Anchorage, a good place to anchor. But I forget the name of the bay now, but it goes up and down. That's the second highest tides. Generally, the world's tides, I think, probably average around 3 or 4 foot tidal change, from high tide to low tide. Pensacola here, it's not even that. It's probably only 2 feet. Very small tidal change. Other places, it's, 50 feet. But the moon is causing these tides. As the Earth is turning under the moon's gravity is pulling on the water. This creates a squeezing effect. On the sides of the Earth, it squeezes in, and it pulls the water up on one side, and because of the squeezing effect, it pushes it out on the other side. So you actually end up getting a high tide on the opposite side from the moon. But the high tide on the other side is not quite as high as the high tide on the near side. If nothing was moving, just the Earth spinning, you would get a high tide every 6 hours. Or you'd get a high tide, 6 hours later you have a low tide, 6 hours later another high tide. It would all be real nice every 6 hours. But because while we're going spinning around, the moon is also moving. And so you have two motions to consider. So the average is every 6 hours and 25 minutes you have a tidal change. Because in 6 hours the moon has moved 25 minutes worth in its orbit around the Earth. Who cares, right? Okay. The point is, if the moon were closer, the tides would be higher. And we'll finish this one thought here and close on this. There's a law in physics called the inverse square law. And I want to put this on the quiz. What is the inverse square law? Be able to explain this. If two objects are attracted to each other, how strongly do they pull each other? Two magnets, let's say. If you get the magnets half the distance apart, you take the fraction one half, inverse it, and square it. It's now four times the pull. If you brought the moon back into one-third the distance, you take that fraction, one-third, inverse it, that means flip it over, and square it. It's nine times the pull. When you're measuring how bright a light is, my dad was an electrical engineer at Caterpillar Tractor Company. He was showing me all these charts and graphs they use. You got a bunch of people in the office, how much light do you want at the desk for the guy to work? Then you got to figure out how far away is your light on your ceiling, how many candle power does it produce? Because if you double the distance, let's say I'm 5 feet away from that light, and it looks to be as bright as 100 candles. If I went 10 feet away, it'd only be as bright as 25 candles. Inverse, I think that's the right number, is that right? Inverse square? I have to do my math on that. But it would drop off as logarithmically as opposed to linearly. As you get closer to the light, you half the distance, it's four times as bright. You half it again, it's 16 times as bright. Inverse square laws, I will cover that in video number 6. They apply when you're dealing with forces involving magnets, gravity, light, and girls. When you half the distance, the attraction is quadruple. A lot of guys don't understand that until it's too late, and we'll get into more of that later. But this inverse square law says if the moon were closer, the tides would be higher, much higher. The problem becomes worse the farther back in time you go. So the evolutionists have tried to answer this by saying, well, you don't know that the moon has always been moving away at the same rate. Good point. I don't. We do know it was closer. And if it's getting farther away, it used to be closer as you go back in time. This does put some kind of time limit. We cover in here evidence from space about the moon. This is which number? Number 5, page 11. You can get more information on this from source number 3, Scott Hughes, The Collapse of Evolution. Number 6 is Dennis Peterson, Unlocking the Mystery of Creation. And number 11, Walter Brown's book, In the Beginning, about the moon. Okay, back up one slide. So I'll ask you to explain what is the inverse square law. That's the law that says as an object gets closer, the gravity increases. The pull, the force of the increases as the inverse of the square of the fraction. That's not a good way to phrase it. Let's just say it like this. If you half the distance, it'll quadruple the traction. If you bring it into one-third the distance, it'll be nine times the pull. And What phenomena does the moon cause on the earth? The tides. Write that down. Heidi, is a quiz question. Also, actually, the moon causes what's called a land tide. As we turn under the moon, Pensacola lifts up about 2 inches. The entire city. We don't notice it because all of Florida is going up 2 inches. You know, goes up, goes back down. Called a land tide. Now, if you get a land tide going up and down, this can create stresses on the crust of the earth a little bit and can trigger earthquakes or can increase the likelihood of them happening. Pardon me? How can you tell the earth is going up? I don't know how they tell that. I'm sure there's ways. Get up there in a helicopter and that wouldn't work because then the air is going up too. Maybe it's just been calculated as opposed to just by the mass of the, you know, done theoretically. I don't know that it's actually been measured. Some things are theoretical and, you know, are logically true but cannot be proven. So that's a good question. Theoretical science instead of empirical science. Okay, so if we ask you on the quiz to name some ways to show the Earth is young, what could you name so far? Quick review.
Population.
Or I should say, phrase the question, Heidi, name some ways to show the universe is young, not the Earth. Population shows the Earth is young. That'd be one, would count. Galaxies are spinning. That's another one. And the difference. The distance to the moon is increasing. Jupiter is cooling off. Ganymede is way too hot. And Saturn still has rings. Those are six we've covered, right? What's that? Tanya, are you griping or complaining? Yes. Okay. Thank you, Tanya. If you're going to be hoving, you have to learn to take ridicule. We get it all the time, right? We gave six. I'll probably say name four ways to show the universe is young. We're going to give it a lot more. Okay. Put that as a question. They're all in the notebook. Yeah. Yeah. For the quiz, we'll say name four ways to prove the universe. That I wouldn't say prove. Four factors that indicate the universe is young. I kind of steer away from the word proof, you know. It's not a good word to use. Okay, any questions what we covered so far? Great. Dismissed. See you next week.